I would love to compete with businesses that have that approach. Maybe you win, maybe you lose.
Good take.
I would love to have my competitors take that approach because I believe we would crush them. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore. We're back with Whiskey Wednesday. My main man, Jake Sheehy.
What's crack-a-lackin'? What's happening?
What's up, buddy?
Today's a great day to be alive.
Great day to be alive. Yes, sir. We start every episode like that. You start them and I end them.
Yes, sir.
You know, I like that.
Feeling amazing today. Great stuff on today's agenda.
Awesome. What do we have today? What are we talking about?
Okay, we're going over some stuff that happened over the weekend real fast, real quick and easy. Then we're going into this 9-to-5, a little friendly debate. Whether or not this is actually a good thing to implement, if people are just complaining, what this means. So hunker down for that one. Then we're going to go into some STR stuff. We're going to give you a great visual, something that people that are listening and watching can visually see when you try and be everything to everyone. Yeah. Cracker Barrel just did it. We're going to go over their mess. Then we're going to talk about if Airbnb moves into hotels, some things we saw. And then we're going to end on Warren Buffett and what he's doing with home builders.
Love it.
First and foremost, here we go.
Okay.
This weekend, we saw the Powerball jackpot, $750 million if you win. If you decided one.
Did somebody hit it? I wasn't paying attention.
No one's hit it yet, if you hit it and you.
Three quarters of $1 billion.
$316 million take home. Cash, baby. Ooh. Cash. So if you haven't, go buy your tickets yet.
I should have stopped on my way home from Idaho.
Dude, you can buy it online. I'm going to buy five tonight. You can do five per person. Five per person.
In Utah? You can buy them in Utah online.
Well, at least I went on the Powerball website last night. Me and Nicole were talking about it.
They're going to say, oh, you're in Utah. You can't get one.
Really?
I don't think you can.
No way. Do I have to drive somewhere else to go get it?
One of the two. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So you got Wyoming, Idaho, Nevada all bordering us. And so you can get up to Wyoming or Idaho the fastest. So,
oh, that's interesting. I didn't even know you couldn't buy the stuff here. All right. Well, so just so people listening, go buy your tickets now. So hopefully you can hit that $316 million. But then you did something fun this weekend. You went to go see Riley Green. How was it?
Riley Green. It was awesome. Yeah. Drake White, Riley Green. It was it was awesome. We went up, pulled the trailer up to Idaho Falls, which is about 3 hours north of us. And it was a smaller venue than what down here in some of the big venues down in Utah. And it was about 5,000 people, sold out. Really fun. Great seats. There wasn't a bad seat in the whole place.
Yeah.
Pretty fun party. And then we went up and floated Big Springs up in Island Park, which is a fun kayaking, paddleboard area up there that we love to float on the Snake River.
That sounds pretty nice.
It was awesome. Great weekend.
Really like Drake. I've never heard. Now, listen, man, I don't listen to country. You like these country people. I've never heard of Drake White or any of these people. I followed him on Instagram. Yeah. He was posting pictures the next day of the event. I'm like, bro, COVID could never. Everyone looks like shoulder to shoulder, tons of people.
Oh yeah.
It seems like a fun time.
It was a blast. Yeah. Everybody comes out to party and have fun. And kids had fun. Teresa and I were there. My brother and his daughter, and they had a blast. And so Drake White, he's a stud. He kind of he's not huge, I guess, in the grand scheme of artists, but man, he was a lot of fun to watch. Okay. And then Riley Green's a stud. We all like him, and so we're all big fans.
I'll see what I can do. Maybe we can get Riley or we can get Drake White on here. I'll see what I'll email their manager or something. We'll figure it out.
Let's get him on. All right. We talked to Larry Fleet, our boy Larry Fleet. He was on.
That's leverage power right there.
We'll say, hey, listen, we've had a couple country guys on.
So yeah, all right. I'll reach out to Drake White. All right, here's the debate. Now, let's just read some of this. Okay, let's just read this a little bit, this exhortation here. According to Fike, now this is like a CEO of some HR consulting firm. According to Fike, the standard schedule of working in office from 9-to-5 is really archaic. Mm. We've seen so many changes in every other area of our lives, yet we are still doing the same thing that our parents and some of our grandparents did in the workplace, she says. The traditional work model can make it difficult and stressful for employees to juggle their own responsibilities. Fike points out that the 9-to-5 schedule doesn't line up with school hours, which makes it challenging for parents to coordinate childcare. We cannot sustain this working environment with so many people burned out and disengaged, she says. Ooh, okay.
You're trying to fire me up.
Dude, I am.
You're trying to fire me up early.
Just a little.
I'm going to keep it. I'm not even getting that fired up.
Come on. Just poke the bear a little bit here. Okay, I'll take the devil's advocate standpoint on this, okay? Now,
Don't tell me you're lobbying for some different hours here. This isn't how you break it to me.
This is not me.
let's have a live debate on Jake's new hours here.
Okay. This is not foreshadowing or subtweeting or anything. Like, this is just
what is the suggestion? She doesn't like the 9 to 5, but what is she suggesting as an alternative?
Less hours and more remote work.
Pretty sure we tried that during COVID, and all the companies went back to in office hours for a reason.
Right.
So can you make the argument that you can actually be productive?
Okay, but what if I could make that argument? Okay. I'll be just as productive at home as I could be here.
Okay.
Right. And I don't feel as stressed, and I don't feel as much disengagement. Right. What do you? Dude, I think I know. Here's another point that I really want to bring up. I don't think people have. Now, this may sound mean, but I don't think people have the mental fortitude to sit at home and either make their own business so they can make their own hours, or have the mental fortitude to actually sit at home and work and do the real work at the same level, same productivity, and same deliverability as they would in an office space. Agree, disagree?
100% agree.
Okay.
I think that this is the problem. Mm-hmm. I would love to know the age of this girl writing this.
Okay.
Because this is the problem when you have very little experience trying to talk about theoretical ideas and things that you have not really tried. If you're going to be as productive or more productive at home, and I mean, basically just say, hey, listen, I don't want to work. I want to get paid full time, but I don't want to work. And that I could respect that article. I'll say, okay, got it. I don't know how that works because you get paid for the value you provide a company, right? If you can provide enough value and you're going to work just as hard, most people are going to start their own deal, right? Mm-hmm. Most people are probably going to work on their own. You know how hard it is to go run your own company? And like I talk to people all the time, and I'm not talking about like people we coach or anything, but I'm talking about like just, you know, in everyday life, my nieces and nephews and everything else. And they have big aspirations of starting their own company. They know that I've worked for myself for 25 years. Mm-hmm. It is very, very difficult to have the discipline to continue to work for yourself. And I promise you, you will work far less hours punching a 9 to 5 clock than you ever will trying to do it all on your own. Mm-hmm. You know, because when you're a business owner, usually you're the chief cook, the bottle washer, the salesperson, the manager, the cleaner, everything else that goes in between all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. It's you end up having to wear so many hats, and there's never any time off. And so if you feel like that you're going to now all of a sudden say, hey, listen, I want to take your money and you pay me to go sit at home, and so that I'm not so stressed out and I'm going to be, provide whatever value. Now, there's people that we have certain people that work remotely at Vodacy.
Right.
And, I'm really careful about who I think can and can't operate at home and be productive. And almost always they're the types of jobs that are more piecework, like kind of more project based, because it's very obvious whether they're doing a good job or not. Sales, like a lot of sales, our sales rep, nobody comes in the office. They all work from home, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's pretty cut and dry whether they're doing a good job or not. And so there are certain jobs that I would agree you can be productive and work from home.
Right.
Here's the other thing that I don't think a lot of young people, and this just makes me sound so old, like I feel like the old guy that's like, you guys are such idiots, right? I don't think that the younger generation values being in an office and being around other people and collaborating with other people that are a few steps ahead of you, that have put in a lot of more time, and you can learn so much just by being a fly on the wall in conversations and in meetings and learning and listening to people that have a lot more experience than you, and you can really accelerate your progress. There's reasons why people say, hey, can you mentor me? You know how many times people reach out, hey, can I buy you a cup of coffee and pick your brain? That's a very common thing for people to say. Well, what happens when you work at a job and you can be around people that you can pick their brain and really expand your knowledge base, your skill sets, everything else that you wouldn't get working from home? And make the argument that you can be more productive. Great. But most of the people, that's who
39. Yeah.
How old?
39.
Older than I thought.
Yeah.
She looks way older than 39.
Oh, she dyed the hair. It's dyed the hair the platinum.
That's kind of rude, but
that is. So I didn't even catch up on that, dude. Yeah, yeah. She's 39. She dyed the hair platinum. She seems like a fine lady. I have rebuttals now. I'm sorry. If you want to finish, finish.
No, you tell me what you're thinking.
No, I'm playing devil's advocate on this. I'm not really. I don't really. I like coming in office. I like the hours. This is just devil's advocate here.
Yeah, okay. We have to have a meeting right after this podcast. You're like setting it up. Let's play devil's advocate. Here we go.
I think mentoring is going away because people feel like. Because for younger people, I'm going to argue that mentoring is going away because they can just find out the information they need online, or they can ask AI. AI will become the new mentor. They don't need another human that they're going to have to bow down to or pay or get judgment from and any of those, or get nervous to ask them. They won't have to go out of their comfort zone. It'll just be AI. And then if to being on the fly on the wall, I think people are so much more isolated and will become more and more isolated from looking at their phones until we just become with VRs on our face or like Wall-E when everyone's just sitting in those chairs, and that they're not going to want to go mingle. They're not going to want to go outside. They're just going to want to stay at home. Why do I have to listen to someone else's opinions and maybe, you know, not say how I truly feel or be embarrassed or any of those things? I think this whole idea of coming into an office and locking arms and working together is gone. I think everyone wants to be alone, do their own remote work, use AI to teach them what to do, and just have a feeding tube, pretty much.
Yeah, well, here's what I say to that.
Okay.
Because I'm a businessman. Okay. I would love to compete with businesses that have that approach. Maybe you win, maybe you lose.
Good take.
Have my competitors take that approach because I believe we would crush them. Yeah. You know, there's a lot that has to do with your culture, what people believe. I mean, we're still human beings. We are made to be a community. Like, that's how we're built, right? And so it is also with the AI stuff. AI is great. Like, we use it all the time. It's a great source of information. We look stuff up all the time.
Yeah.
I can tell you with 100% certainty that when I look up stuff from my 25 years of experience in investing that I completely disagree with, that what AI spits out. AI is just spitting out a copy of a copy of a copy.
Right.
And it's regurgitating all that information. And some of it can be super factual and accurate and everything else. Mm-hmm. But if you have zero experience, what if you only have on certain topics, you have 85%, you're 85% accurate. But that 15%, you don't know what 15%'s not accurate or isn't going to work. And somebody with a lot of experience can look at it and say, yeah, this is mostly right, but here's where it goes wrong. Here's the piece that you want to change. And you'll find that out, and again, I feel like we had a pretty good case study on remote work and a pretty good case study of people disengaging and not coming into the office through the COVID years. And there's a reason why all of your major companies who pivoted that way are saying, nope, we're coming back in the office. Nope, we need to be around each other. We need to collaborate. That's the Napoleon Hill's, the power of the mastermind concept, and saying, hey, listen, two minds are better than one. Three is better than two. And you can get together. And that I believe rings more true now than it ever has, because you also do have these people that say, hey, listen, I'm going to run down this other road and it's too stressful and this and that and the other. The issue is life doesn't care. So what if you're right?
Wow. Okay. I mean, here's another thing. This is from, so while you're talking, I'm like, you know what? It's hard to play the devil's advocate that people are going to want to stay at home, because when we did have to stay at home, like you're right, during COVID, mental health, like anxiety and depression, skyrocketed. Yeah,
it was worse. So how are you making that argument now? Because I get the argument if you didn't have a pretty good case study. I mean, to say that we haven't looked at this pretty closely, and it's pretty close in our rearview mirror. It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
And to say it just doesn't seem to work. And I can see why it doesn't work. As a business owner, you want to be around people. I like to come into the office. I like to hear everybody's ideas. There's a ton of stuff that we talk about and we do that is just like, hey, Jake, hey, Jacob, we're yelling back and forth down the office and we talk about different things around lunch and all those different things that are just, you're not going to get when you're working from home.
Yeah.
And,
as a devil advocate, you kind of just destroyed my argument, man. People aren't supposed to be alone, I don't think. I think it's good to, to have.
I think that we've seen what happens to mm-hmm. stress levels and anxiety and depression and everything else, it skyrockets when you're not around people. It's just not how we're built.
All right. All right. Let's move on from that. Okay, let's go into this Cracker Barrel thing. So now if you're listening or watching, you don't know, Cracker Barrel came out with their new logo and they're going to start doing their new interior design changes. The result has been catastrophic. Okay. People are going up in arms about how this logo sucks. It's terrible. It's crap. If you're listening, look it up. If you're watching, I'll post the picture of the two different kinds of logos. And then their interior design, you know, if you've ever been to a Cracker Barrel, it's got the stuff on the walls. Yeah. It's kind of that wooden feeling to
old
it.
Old country store.
Old country like store.
Old all that school stuff. Games and toys right. and candies that you're yes. not going to find anywhere. Yes. Right? Like, yeah.
All that stuff, right? There's a cast iron skillet hanging on the wall. And like, right. it's that old style. But now, if you look up photos of their interior design, things are organized very in lines. And it's the classic booth look. And it's very taking a lot of this personalized, unique experience that we've talked about, and they're doing away with it. And so this article comes out. It says, Cracker Barrel loses almost $100 million in value as stock plunges after new logo release. They dropped 7.2%, pretty terribly. And I kind of just want to touch on this as this is, in my opinion, clear evidence to things that you've been preaching of when you deliver that personalized, unique experience, yeah. right? And you try and be everything to everyone, it loses its value, mm-hmm. right? I mean, what's the
exactly?
You know, I could go pancakes from anywhere now,
right? Exactly. yeah. What makes it? First of all, too. Oh my gosh. What? Know your audience, right?
Oh, come on.
Who goes to Cracker Barrel, yeah. right? And it's like you go to Cracker Barrel for a reason. Yes. You know, biscuits and gravy and pancakes and some
meatloaf.
Yeah, right.
Come on.
I mean, it's not. And and you're going there for that experience, right? Mm-hmm. And now they're going to sterilize the experience yeah, and make it just completely bland. And we're going to remove all of that stuff because some, you know, woke executive in New York decided this is what we're going to do. And we don't like this in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, you guys, please. And this has nothing to do with being woke or unwoke. This is we're talking about. They just sterilized a very unique personalized type of an experience. Mm-hmm. Anybody that said Cracker Barrel and you walk into a Cracker Barrel, you knew what you were going into.
Right.
You're in the waiting room. You're looking at the Christmas ornaments that are, you know, the grandma made.
Playing checkers.
Yeah, and you got checkers there and you got the old school candies and you got just all kinds of knickknacks everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what you got when you went to Cracker Barrel.
Right.
Now they're going to completely remove all that, make it look like any other diner, any other pancake diner that you walk into, and all of a sudden it's you blend into the crowd, you become, you know, you decide, hey, listen, we're not going to stand out, we're not going to be different, which means the consumer has no reason to now. It's just like you said, it's another pancake joint, it's another meatloaf joint.
I know now you're just competing against Denny's, Shoney's, IHOP, all the other ones.
Exactly,
you're just competing against them now. Here's another thing I thought about while you're talking about when you walk into a Cracker Barrel. You would never think, oh, this is how I want to design my home, right?
Exactly.
Just like
just like this, right?
I mean, you would never go, oh, I want the cast iron skillet on the wall. No, you wouldn't design it like that. But you know that this is a fun experience, and you go. And sometimes, let's be honest, maybe the food isn't that amazing, but it's the experience, and you're willing to go there because of that. Same with the short-term rental. You wouldn't design it this way like you would in your normal home, but it's giving that extra layer, that personalized, unique experience, and oof, they took it away, and now you can clearly see the results of that. So just an example.
Yeah, talk about consumer behavior all the time. Boy, they forgot about consumer behavior on this move. And the reasons consumers, you know, they become loyal to brands. But just like you said, I don't want my kitchen to look like that. But when I go in there, I kind of remember grandma's kitchen, you know, and it reminds me of different times in my life. And we're like, oh, this is kind of fun.
Yeah.
You know, I'd never do this in my house. But it's kind of a fun experience.
Yeah.
You know, and they just removed that. Mm. Like they're going to, I'm surprised it only dropped $100 million.
I know.
I mean, 7%. Well,
let's just see how it goes. I mean, if they continue to do the renovations, I mean, I don't know, man. It's going to be tough. And when you look at places like, have you heard about the Red Lobster one? The Red Lobster hired a young CEO and he realized, okay, we were like taking all the things that people wanted away from the restaurant. So he's implementing it back and now their stock is skyrocketing. So he's pretty much doing the reverse of what Cracker Barrel is doing. So
you can see the long-term
effects of these things.
And it's like one, you know that consumers pay for unique personalized experiences. We mm-hmm. pay for differentiation, something mm-hmm. that's different. Mm-hmm. You just took away all of those things and you just made yourself blend into the crowd. You become a commodity. You're not giving the consumer a reason to go there other than the, your amazing food. And mm-hmm. that's not what Cracker Barrel is known for, right? I know, dude. None of us go there because they have the best food in the world. Right, we go there because of the experience. Mm-hmm. And that's what, I mean, obviously we're in the experience business. So it's a good lesson to you know, for those of the investors that are in the short-term rental world thinking, well, I need to be a little everything to everybody. And we keep saying, no, you don't.
Yeah.
Pick an audience, lean into that experience, mm-hmm. deliver something, you know, unique and different and personalized to a specific audience. Mm. Cracker Barrel just removed all of that. Yeah. And that's just basic consumer behavior, giving the consumer a reason to spend their money with you mm-hmm. versus somebody else. And now you didn't give them a reason. Mm. And so you're going to get your fair share of business. Well, unfortunately, the markets are pretty brutal. They're pretty unforgiving. Oh. And so the marketplace is going to say, well, your fair share of business, mm-hmm. the way you're set up is X. And I wouldn't be surprised if we don't see, you mm-hmm. know, we'll see the Chapter 11 bankruptcy filings of Cracker Barrel.
Unfortunately, that's such a bummer.
You don't want that. Hopefully they make a pivot. Hopefully they make a change. Hopefully they say, hey, listen, the market has spoken. Right. Mm-hmm. Let's maybe not lean into this change that we thought was a good idea. We all make mistakes, mm-hmm. right?
Right?
It's what do you learn from the mistake and can you pivot?
Right.
And this has nothing to do that they can go right back to creating that unique experience.
Yeah.
I mean, I doubt that any of the remodels have happened yet.
Right.
Maybe they have, but I doubt all of them have.
Yeah. And not all of them for sure. So I mean, you just listen, dude.
Yeah.
I mean,
listen to the marketplace.
Yeah. All right. Moving into this new take. I see this on this, this website here about, short-term rentals.
Yeah.
Here's what it says. Let's read this. Alongside the cautious outlook, CEO Brian Chesky made a point saying Airbnb will be going significantly more aggressively into hotels. Sounds odd, but that's what he said. This move puts Airbnb directly up against archivalbooking.com, a platform that not only dominates online hotel distribution in Europe, but also offers millions of short-term rentals. While Airbnb built its brand on disrupting the hotel industry, Booking.com has long mastered the mix of hotels and alternative accommodation, and now Airbnb is signaling it wants to compete on both fronts.
Yeah.
Right off the bat here, Airbnb goes into hotels. Is that fear that comes to your mind, or you go, oh no, that's just another industry to dominate and we know what to do
with that? Yeah, I mean, we're in the hospitality industry. I mean, travelers, like I've always said, I don't really think short-term rentals and hotels compete necessarily with each other many times. I think there's a place for short-term rentals, there's a place for hotels. Uh-huh. And I think there always will be. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily a bad move. They keep trying to figure out what things they're going to lean into. They've leaned into experiences mm-hmm. and services. Those are very small, mm-hmm. moving the needle very little, it seems like, mm-hmm. As far as what they're trying to do as a company. And they're looking at something that's a bigger move. Mm. And he's making the announcement that they're going to aggressively get in the hotel space. Well, makes sense. It's a different type of a product than what they have offered. Booking.com is the largest OTA in the world. Mm-hmm. A lot of us, we think it's Airbnb and Vrbo. It's not even close. Booking.com is by far the dominant player when it comes to the overall size of an OTA because they have hotels on there.
Right.
Right. So they've got hotels and millions of STRs. Mm. So they're saying, hey, maybe we're gonna go into that. And I don't think it's a bad move. Mm-hmm. I actually welcome it because when people see some of the hotel prices mm-hmm. versus what you can get an STR for, mm-hmm. if a consumer really is comparing, mm-hmm. maybe I'll stay at a hotel, maybe I'll stay at a short-term rental. Mm-hmm. I just had to go to Dallas last week. Mm-hmm. And I won't say the name of the hotel I stayed at, but mm-hmm. it was a major brand airport mm-hmm. hotel at a major brand and mm-hmm. not a cheap one. It was like mm-hmm. $400 a night. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the most expensive, not the cheapest. Mm-hmm. It was garbage.
Really?
And I'm thinking, Hold on, my gosh.
Tell me about this. Why?
Well, it was, I mean, I'm talking like stains on everything, like stains all your draperies on the carpets.
Really?
There was rusted fixtures uh-huh. everywhere. Nothing had been repainted. I mean, it was in pretty bad shape. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, man, the deferred maintenance on this is horrible. Mm. It's a major brand. Mm-hmm. And it was, I was just in and out. I flew in that Wednesday night, flew out Thursday afternoon. And so it didn't make sense. And I'm not going to choose an SDR over that because of cleaning and everything else. I just needed an in and out. I wanted to be right at the airport. My options are the hotel brands. But when I can compare what you could get in that area for an STR for basically the same price per night or less even.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, holy crap, my money is way better spent at an STR. So sometimes it might be nice as a investor to see have the consumer have choices. More choices the consumer has, I always feel like it's better for the marketplace. And so it's a matter of how are they going to, you know, how are they going to compile it and everything else. You don't want to muddy it up so much because I feel like if somebody is interested in hotels, a lot of times they're going through booking.com or and so they've already kind of got that established customer base, and or a lot of the major hotel brands have the loyalty points programs and everything else. And so a lot of times they just go book direct. So I know that if we read more into the article, it said they're going to really try to initially focus on the boutique hotel brands, the boutique hotels, and which I think is great. And I think it's a good marketplace for the boutique hotel investors to be able to place their properties. A lot of them are placing them on Airbnb anyways. And so they're just going to probably now have a category of that and really aggressively go try to recruit some of those as that becomes more and more popular.
I was thinking about like the design of the hotel while you were talking. I'm thinking, I mean, the STR has such a unique feel to it because, I mean, you got the kitchen, you could have outdoor area with the pool, or you could have the hot tub, the golf, mini golf, or, fun little activities or something. And it really is an experience, in my opinion. When I personally think short-term, I think experience, right? But when I think hotel, I just think it's a stay. It's a room.
Right.
It's a room in a bed, pretty much. I'm not going to really be in the hotel hanging out, partying, doing whatever as I would in the short-term rental.
Right.
So it seems in my personal head a completely different experience on how the design of that would work. Would you just target it for people on business, or like how would you kind of make your ST or your, I don't know, well, I mean, what would you call it? Your hotel room stand out, you know?
Well, a lot of the boutique hotels, we have members that have, that are building portfolios of boutique hotels. And I'm talking about 10 to 50 unit like hotel motels, right? Okay. And a lot of times they've gone in and renovated them. I'm thinking about one that's it's in a mountain biking area, and all the rooms have mountain biking stations, and they have some common area that have different like areas where they can go fix their mountain bikes at the end of the day, right? I don't know what they're called, like the garage area that they go into, and then everything is still themed out. But again, you're missing out on, you don't have full kitchens in there. You don't have multiple rooms. There's still going to be hotel rooms.
Right.
But some of these boutique hotels are still in destination areas where the big hotel brands aren't. We automatically think of the Hiltons and the Marriotts and everything else, right? In the big areas when we think of hotels. There's a lot of the boutique hotels, which is what I think the Airbnb is going to try to lean into. And it's also a good platform for those, because you might just have a traveler you don't have the big cleaning fees and everything else because you're just paying the nightly rate.
Right.
And a lot of times that's included. You're still going to have the same, the hospitality taxes and stuff are all going to be the same, across the board, depending on the county that you're in. But there's a lot of boutique hotels that lean into different experiences, whether they're kind of romantic, type hotels, the adults only. You've got the adventure seeker type of boutique hotels. They're still going to try to, especially the more boutique they are, they're still going to lean into that, that creative experience.
Yeah, I think you definitely reeled it in my head. I was thinking big skyscraper Marriott, click the elevator button. But if it's like 10, 15, then you could you could really decorate each room individually, or do one like every couple gets their own room or something. I mean,
there's a lot of options.
There's a lot of room.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I want to pick your brain on that. Now, last topic here. Warren Buffett, he's investing into home builders. Now, I kind of want you once again to explain this thing, especially for listeners. Why would he do this?
Yeah.
Why do we care about this at all?
One, this is a big move, right? In August, so just, last month, Warren Buffett invested over $1 billion into two major home builders, D.R. Horton and Lennar.
Okay.
And it's significant for a number of reasons. the last big investment he made into the home building space was in 2022 or 2023, and then sold it almost a year later. So he got in and got out, right? And then now he's getting, and that was like $200 million. He's doubling down and putting over $1 billion into these home builders and showing his confidence in what he feels like is going to be, you know, probably a nice run up. One of the things that he talks about is the well, he doesn't really talk about it, but speculation is saying, hey, listen, there's still a major shortage of supply. That doesn't get talked about still a lot. We talk about it a lot. That gap between supply and demand is still really, really wide. It's why it gives us confidence that the market, the bottom of the market's not falling out anytime soon, right? And we don't feel like that the bubble is about to burst. In fact, I think it's just the opposite. The minute rates start to come down, I think we're going to see another skyrocket in prices. And I think that you're starting to see this from, you know, the Oracle, air quotes, in that, that, you know...
Warren Buffett is the Oracle.
It's called the Oracle.
Yeah. He's ridiculous, dude.
I mean, he's I mean, he deserves it, probably. Yeah. But he always also talks about his. This is a bit of a contrarian move at this time because he's a little ahead of his game of saying, "Hey, listen, there's going to be a lot more people probably jumping into this one when." Investor confidence in home builders is a little bit higher, but that gap. This article, where's this coming from? This is.
Let me see here.
FloridaCustomHomes.com. I don't know if that's a reprint of an AP article. It looks like it might be. Go down, but it's showing that there 5.5 to 6.8 million homes is an estimated U.S. shortfall in the housing in the housing market. That's a lot of homes.
That's a crap ton of homes.
You know, anywhere from 5.5 to almost 7 million homes is a supply and demand gap.
So he wants to fix that. He's saying these people want homes. There's not enough. I'm going to go in and build them.
Right. That's, he's saying, hey, listen, like, and then he's saying, you know, that's what he calls that, what does he call that?
Economic
moat. Is investing in business with enduring demand and pricing power in what he often calls his economic moat. So he's got this demand that's not going away. It's built in. We've seen this demand. It's been that gap between supply and demand has been wide for ever since the last crash of 2008 to 10, when a lot of home builders stopped building, a lot of suppliers got out for a while, and that demand, as soon as that demand took off, they just haven't been able to catch up. And we've seen it the whole time, right? And so this gap, even though you see articles about inventories going up over year, and which it is, but it's nowhere near enough to cover this gap of almost, you know, 5.5 to 6.8 million homes is the estimated shortage. Buffett is saying, hey, listen, these big home builders, they own a lot of land. If I infuse them with some cash and we buy all these stocks and they can start building out a lot of this and start to have product to sell when demand skyrockets, when interest rates come down. Powell also just had a conversation last week with his strongest indication saying that rates are probably going to start going down. They have reason to believe, and you know, we're going to be careful and cautious, but we're thinking that there might be some rate cuts in the future. You start to you know, if you don't think that the Oracle has, you know, pays attention to those types of things, you're crazy. You know, and he's Oracle. Like, he knows what he, you know, he's proven he knows what he's doing. So this is really, this is really good news for real estate investors in the real estate market saying, hey, listen, we might, you know, we might be seeing another run up of home prices going up, consumer confidence going up and getting back into the market. There's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines. And so, 87% chance probability of rate cut at the September meeting.
That's a huge 87% probability that the rates are going to go down. So this is a chess move. So I want to make sure I understand this correctly, what the Oracle's saying. This is a chess move from the Oracle. He's saying there's demand that's needed. People want homes. You know, there's more inventory. I guess people are selling those homes, but they don't want those. They still need more. We're trying to catch up. I'm going to go in. I'm going to make these homes. Then the rates are going to...
He's investing in companies.
He's going to invest in companies to make these homes. The rates are going to go down. So now people can start to afford homes more. I can kind of bump up my prices a little bit more to make money off these houses. But now who's to say that these houses are going to be... I guess... I guess in his position, he can make any kind of house he needs to.
Right.
It doesn't need to be exactly unique or any kind of way, because he just needs to fill the gap.
He's saying, hey, I just need to build a house and be profitable.
Right.
Or these companies, Lennar and D.R. D.R. Horton, which he has confidence they will. They're major home builders. They've got infrastructure in place to build a lot of homes. Mm. So he can get a, you know, it's not like mom and pop, you know, general contractor trying to build six homes a year, yeah. right? And
these people make neighborhoods.
Yeah, they're building neighborhoods. They're building cities sometimes. Yeah. And so it's like they've got the infrastructure and the teams in place to do this. Mm-hmm. He also, yeah. I mean, you know, Berkshire Hathaway, which is Warren Buffett's companies, I mean, they own a lot of suppliers from the lumber to the siding to the roofing. Wow. They own all the supply companies as well. So ultimately, they become their own customers. And so it's this, he's created this moat that he says, this economic moat that it's a great move. And he's also saying, you know, at the end of the day, somebody has to buy these homes. That's where for us, it looks, you know, from the outside looking in, it's like, okay, that, you know, if a guy that's a lot smarter than us, you know, is pretty confident that, you know, in the things that we've been saying, that there's a supply and demand gap, you know, and there's a supply shortage, he can go in and, you know, invest in these companies that can help with that supply. But also that gap, that's a good hedge in your bet, knowing that the demand far exceeds supply right now by 5.5 to $6.8 million homes. Last I heard, and it might be different now because this was probably 5 or 6 years ago that I heard this stat, that the U.S. home builders could only build about 2 million homes a year. And so you're talking about a four-year gap. That's crazy.
That seems like so little. Here's another question. I don't know if you know this about the Oracle.
How many homes can U.S. home builders build a year? Can combined U.S. home builders build in a year?
Can combined U.S. home builders build in a year?
Yeah.
Let's see here.
Let's see what that
this
says.
This is another question I have. Maybe we don't know this off the top.
Yeah, 1.5 million units.
Over the next decade.
Housing, approximately 1.6 million housing units in 2024 combined.
You're going to take years.
So
the need's going to keep going.
So that just that stat, we've been talking about this stat for years when people say, I'm going to wait for prices to come down. You're like, guys, real estate is fairly simple economics, first of all. It's supply and demand driven. The supply and demand gap is so wide that you're not going to have a complete drop in prices because the demand is not going to allow it. We're 5.5 million homes short, and they're in 2024 they built 1.6 million homes. I mean, you've got a 5 or 6 year deficit of if they're to build out of this problem. And that's where he's showing the confidence, saying, hey, listen, I feel really confident to drop $1 billion investment in two companies. One of them's $800 million, the other one's $200 million. I mean, it's a lot of money that, you know, I don't know if people realize how much $1 billion is. That's a lot of damn money that you're investing, saying, hey, listen, I feel pretty good that I'm hedging the bets hedging the odds in my favor because of that stat alone. That's pretty much all that needs to be said. And we've been saying it for a long time, but it gives us a lot of confidence when you see somebody else like a Warren Buffett that's doubling down on that same thing.
All right. I got two questions. Okay. First one, I don't even know either of us know this answer here, but if Warren owns like the lumber and the all the supplies, is he's doing some serious chess moves saying, I'm going to invest into these builders. They're going to buy my lumber products and I'm going to sell the house. So he's making money on multiple avenue streams here, right?
That's why he's called the Oracle.
Bro, that's okay. First of all, that's awesome. That is awesome. But then, okay, so you're saying people should not wait for these new homes to come in because no matter what, there's still going to be a moat. You shouldn't wait for the new homes to be built from Buffett either.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're.
Should you wait for the rates to drop? I guess is my question.
Maybe and see him. I mean, okay. So rates are you can refinance at any point.
Right.
When rates drop, prices go up. Okay. So you're probably the point of all this is the house is going to be worth more tomorrow than it is today, likely. Okay. Right. And so, and I put an asterisk that nobody has the crystal ball except for maybe the Oracle. And so, but the point is, based on all this information, our best guess is that prices are going to be worth more tomorrow than they are today.
Okay.
Rates are probably going to be less tomorrow than they are today. So what would you do if you're an investor? Let's say you don't own a home right now. If you hear those two things in your head, what are you thinking? Are you better off buying now or waiting till rates drop?
I would say, let me end. Here we go. You ready? Okay. I would think I should wait for rates to drop because no matter what, the real estate will always be more the next day. So I would rather have a lower rate so I can pay less.
So you can pay more for the house though.
And still have the real estate make more because either way, it's going to be worth more tomorrow than it is today.
So, okay. So I like your answer sort of.
Okay.
So when is the best time to buy a house?
Well, every time I hear investors, they say yesterday. I wish I knew earlier.
When is the best time? The next best time?
Today.
So why would you wait?
Well,
because you want the lower rate, right?
Right.
But your buying power seems better. But the problem is when rates lower, with these stats, it's very, very likely that prices are going to go up. So let's say you could buy a house today for $400,000.
Okay.
And you want to wait till rates drop. Well, when rates drop, all of a sudden we see prices start to go up. Let's say the prices went up, 8 or 10%, because that would be maybe likely in some of these markets. Mm-hmm. So now that $400,000 house, let's say it's now at $450,000. Okay, so you're paying $50,000 more. In your head, you're saying, "Well, my rate today was 6.5. Maybe it's going to be 5.5 tomorrow. So my payment's about the same, and I got a lower rate. And then it's going to keep going up." True. All that's true, except for you just paid $50,000 more for that house. Now, or you could buy it today, pay a little higher rate for maybe the next 6 months or a year. When rates drop to 5.5, you refinance and you have a lower payment on a $400,000 house instead of a lower payment on a $450,000 house or a payment on a $450,000 house at a lower rate.
That was the key. That
it's
really
a $50,000 difference in that scenario by waiting. $50,000 is a lot of money that a lot of people forget about, and they focus on the one thing that you can maneuver and change. You pay a couple grand and you refinance, right? Or let's say your refinance costs you $3,000 to $5,000 to refinance that loan. And you're like, well, there's cost to the refinance. Okay, it costs you $3,000 to $5,000. You're still net ahead because that house went up by $50,000. In some of these markets, back when COVID hit and prices started skyrocketing, properties they were going up $50,000 every 2 months. I mean, they were going crazy, right? So they were just, people were paying $50,000 or $60,000 just to get an offer accepted over ask price. And so if it actually goes that crazy because they actually drop rates a little too aggressively, which is why I think they got to be careful, right?
Okay.
You know, you talk to Donald Trump and he wants 0% interest rates. Well, that doesn't do, all of a sudden prices are going to double overnight. We don't necessarily want that either.
Okay.
Powell's like, hey, listen, I don't like you, Donald Trump. And so I'm going to keep rates as high as they are. I think that they need to settle down and come down. But when they do, based on all this information, prices are likely to go up pretty significantly in some cases. And so when is the best time to buy?
Right now.
It always is. It's like right now is the best time to buy. Yesterday was the best time. Now is the next best time.
Okay.
It still has to make sense. How many properties do we underwrite? Depending on your end usage of the property. We talk about short-term rentals all the time. Maybe you're buying a property for a long-term rental. Maybe you're buying it for your own personal home. You can't bite off more than you're going to chew. The property, if it's an investment, needs to be able to generate enough income to service all the debt, the management fees, all the expenses on the property. All those different things have to underwrite still. And you might say no to a whole bunch of properties. So I'm not saying just go buy anything and everything.
Right.
I'm saying timing the market is very, very difficult, first of all. Second, we're seeing some really good indications of things that are saying now's a pretty dang good time to be to be buying properties.
Right.
You know, we've got some really favorable tax advantages right now. We're seeing things that are likely going to bring the property prices up significantly in the short term, maybe in short term being a year or less. In the next year, we're probably going to see rate cuts, which is going to probably spur prices to go up and maybe sometimes significantly, depending on how aggressive the rate cuts are. And so why not be thinking about buying right now, depending on your situation and the asset class you're going into, there's very few asset classes right now that are, in my opinion, not very attractive.
Yeah. Man. Okay.
Sorry, that's a lot.
No. I liked it because that really helped in my head. If you buy now, right, you can still get that rate, the interest rate that I was going to hold out for by just refinancing later down the road. Yeah,
you pay a couple grand to refinance.
You'll still get that rate, and you won't have that feeling of like, oh, I should have done it before. Like you hear tons of investors say, all of them, I wish I did this before. I wish I did it yesterday. So you could still, you still get best of both worlds, and your property is still going up in value.
Yeah.
So, wow. Okay, that really helped. So I would get the property now. I wouldn't wait.
Okay, so we changed our answer. That's the great thing about these conversations.
Yeah.
The thing with my tests, Jake, I always give you a pencil with an eraser so you can change your answer.
That's okay. Okay, dude. Okay, dude.
But right. Change your answer.
Well, I would do it, man. I would get the house now.
Awesome.
That's it, man. That's all I had for today. We're at almost 45 minutes.
Okay. Oh, yeah, man. That means I rambled on a few things for a little bit.
I did too.
That's all right.
I did too.
All right, guys. Well, we'll wrap it up. We always appreciate you spending your time with us. We know it's valuable. If you got any value out of this show, you guys know that I ask you the favor every episode to share the show. Those things help us a lot. If you have more than 30 seconds, like it or review it on whatever platform you're watching or listening on. And the final, most important thing at the end of every episode, pick that one thing you can do today, start building that life. You don't want to take a vacation from. Cheers, my friends.
Cheers.
Thanks for joining.